This morning, we do part three of the series, and just in case you're not sure what parts one and two were or how they fit together, I thought I'd begin by kind of reviewing the three questions for Advent that I laid out on Monday morning. The first question that I've been trying to lead us in discussion of this week is the question of who is the Christ that we expect in the season of Advent. The second question was, into what situation does that Christ come to us? And the third question, which is the predominant theme for this morning, is what hope does that Christ bring to our world? Now, in terms of the first question, who is the Christ? I was trying to say on Monday that I thought we needed a larger view of Christ, that the Christ we expect in the season of Advent is a Christ which includes at least the whole of the body of Christ. And maybe still another dimension to that, Christ is not only the whole of the body, but the process of that whole body becoming one. There's a strong theme running through the New Testament of the oneness of Christ's body as a goal to work for, Paul talks about. A whole that somehow becomes larger, but the notion that Christ's body is made up of many parts, some of which are coming into being a little earlier than others, but that the people of God in their oneness should be the whole body of Christ. Now, I guess I just, by way of review a little bit and continuing reminder, want to make the point that our vision of the wholeness of Christ, our vision, meaning our Western vision, and maybe even more narrowly our white Western vision, has tended to be skewed by what I call a narrow worldview. And the quickest way I know of making that point is to think a little bit about the images of the world that we carry with us. If I were to ask each of you to bring to mind a two-dimensional image of the world, chances are high that the image which predominates in your mind is that of the Mercator projection. Because the Mercator projection is the dominant two-dimensional image that we Americans have grown up with. It's still the predominant map of the world that's used in classrooms in this country. But the Mercator projection was designed some, 400 years ago by Europeans who needed a two-dimensional image of the world that would enable them to set sail from Europe and accurately determine distance and direction from the continent of Europe to other parts of the world. And the Mercator projection still accomplishes that task better than any other two-dimensional representation of the Earth's surface that's been developed. But of course, no effort to translate a round sphere to a flat surface can be perfect. There's always got to be distortions involved there. And so the issue is not having a true map so much as being clear about what factors one wants to truly represent and what factors it's okay to distort. Now, on the Mercator projection, as I said, the factors which its designers and its original users wanted to be true about were factors of determining distance and direction from Europe. And if you are setting sail from Europe today, the best map for you still to use is the Mercator projection. If, on the other hand, you want to get some idea of the relative size of the Earth's continents, you know, we hear so much talk about the debate between the North and the South and the idea that the Southern Hemisphere is beginning to come into its own and wants a better deal from the Northern Hemisphere. If we want a map or an image which gives us some accurate representation of the relative size of the Earth's continents, then we dare not use the Mercator projection, which is centered, first of all, in Europe rather than the equator, and which grossly distorts the relative size of the Earth's continents. For that reason, a cartographer named Arno Peters in 1974 produced the North and South map, which I believe is around the village and will not be unfamiliar, at least not to all of you. Can you all see this?
No.
How's that? Can you still see it in the back?
Yeah.
The north and south map claims absolute fidelity of area, meaning it shows the true relative size of the Earth's continents. Now, as I said, no map is perfect, and this one has its biases as well as any other. This one is biased in favor of, or biases the shape of the Earth's continents. It's necessary to alter the shape in order to reflect the true relative size. But the relative size of the Earth's continents are true on this map. And you can see that it's a shocking difference from the image of the world that we, or at least I, was raised on. The Mercator projection is represented several times down below here. You can see where the equator falls on the equator projection. It's at the bottom third of the map rather than in the center, which is where it falls on the north and south map. Or look at the relative land mass illustrated between of Europe and South America on the Mercator projection. Europe appears to be about as large as, or maybe even a little larger than South America on the north and south map, which is perhaps why we grow up thinking that European history is so much more important than South American history. Yet on the north and south map, which claims absolute fidelity of area, it's clear that Europe is not larger than South America. Likewise, we hear a lot of talk about the threat that the Soviet Union poses vis-a-vis Africa. Now, I'm sure that not all of that talk is related to a sense of geography, but I do believe that geography plays a fundamental role in how we shape our images of the world, or our sense of geography does, and that for that reason it is important to have a sense of how Africa geographically relates to the rest of the world. And on the north and south map you can see that it's bigger than we were led to believe, at least by the Mercator projection. So I like using this resource of the north and south map as an example that the worldview, which we Americans carry around, is perhaps outdated, or at least not as large and full as we might like to think. Sometimes I think my ministry is about trying to expand a worldview, and I can tell you that going into an adult class in a congregation on a Sunday morning and telling them that we need a larger worldview doesn't always go over very big. There's a sense in which we Americans think of ourselves as being very sophisticated, better educated than other people in the world, and the only reason we don't pay much attention to the rest of the world is because we don't need to. We are the pinnacle of the world's development and success, et cetera, et cetera. You all know that line. So I find that the North and South map is, because of its academic credibility, you know, I mean, it is technically accurate in what it claims to do. It's the quickest way I know of making the point that maybe there is room for improvement in our worldview. I learned last night that having introduced this, I don't think I was the first to introduce this resource, but having talked about the resource here in the village and even brought along a copy of it, which I sell with my little the logo and tag on the bottom corner there, last March, I learned that the new Holden Village Resource Center picked up the idea and is now competing with me for sales of the map, and to make matters worse, has undercut my price. So I want to hereby announce the beginning of a price war with Holden Village, and I'll...
We'll lower ours again, won't we, Dan?
Well, I get my copies cheaper than you do, so I think ultimately I can beat you.
Soon we do,
we'll quit. That's true. I think that if we read Corinthians, I forgot to bring my Bible, fortunately, there's probably one at hand. If we read 1 Corinthians, we get some instruction on what I call the two kinds of unity. I mean, as I said, that the issue of knowing Christ, or of answering the question, who is Christ, really involves a notion of, or ought to involve a notion of wholeness, and I don't mean to suggest that the body of Christ is the whole of Christ but is certainly a dimension of knowing Christ that I think we need to work on and improve. And a second part of that knowledge of Christ is the process of Christ's body becoming one. That's an activity which is in process. There is the objective body of Christ that we know to exist out there in the world, but there is also the process of that body becoming one. And that's really a process of growing unity. And I think it's good for us Westerners to think about the different types of unity or the different ways that unity can come. Because I think the Bible calls for one way, and I think we in Western culture have been pursuing quite a different manner of unity. As I think about it or understand it, there are two ways that you can have unity. One is a kind of imperial form of unity, where let's take the example of doctrinal unity now. I, as a theologian, come into a situation and seek to establish unity. I can do that by getting everyone to agree or to adhere to my sense of doctrine. I call that a kind of imperial unity, where someone or some force is authoritative and establishes unity by getting everyone else to think the same way. And that's really, I think, the sort of unity that the expansion of Western culture has pursued, is the idea that we have the gospel, and what we're called to do is duplicate our understanding of the gospel around the world, whether that be the gospel of whether that be a strictly theological gospel, or whether it be an economic gospel. Keep in mind the policies of our government and multinationals, which say you are either with us in our camp, you do the economic things the way we do them, or you're on the other side and outside of our circles. So that imperial form of unity is one type of unity, which is of which there are many prominent examples in the world. But I don't think it's the kind of unity that the New Testament calls us to. And it certainly is not the kind of unity that's being spoken about in 1 Corinthians 12, beginning at verse 12. For just as the body is one and has many members, and all the members of the body, though many, are one body, so it is with Christ. For by one Spirit we were all baptized into one body, Jews or Greeks, slaves or free, black or white, men or women, and all were made to drink of one Spirit. For the body does not consist of one member, but of many. If the foot should say, because I am not a hand, I do not belong to the body, that would not make it any less a part of the body. And if the ear should say, because I am not an eye, I do not belong to the body, that would not make it any less a part of the body. If the whole body were an eye, where would be the hearing? If the whole body were an ear, where would be the sense of smell? But as it is, God arranged the organs of the body, each one of them as he chose. The kind of unity that is being pointed to there, I would call a dynamic or an organic vision of unity. The notion that out of the diversity, there can be a kind of unity which is very dynamic. When the process of its becoming one organic whole is undertaken and achieved. To take the Corinthians analogy and extend it to our economic situation. Well, maybe that wouldn't be a good analogy, because I'm sure there's a lot of good capitalists who think that if the whole world did economics the way we did it, then everything would be just fine. So I won't pursue that analogy, but you get the point I'm trying to make, that I think it's actually a richer experience to pursue the kind of unity which says there is strength in diversity, rather than the kind of unity which is almost threatened by any differences and which insists on a uniformity or a homogeneity in order to achieve its unified purpose. Yes.
I'm struck that that's exactly the same thing that goes on in environmental, in the environment.
Uh-huh. You mean the unity of diverse processes.
The more
stable it is. Uh-huh. That's a good point. Yeah. It's also a tremendously liberating thing to me to think that as a white Westerner who has been ingrained with notions since before I was born that the future of the world really depends on my leadership is a tremendously liberating thing to me, to think that I don't have to come up with all the solutions to the world, that all I have to do is play my one part, and maybe in historical cultural terms my role of leadership has already been, you know, has already run its course, and then it's now time for white Westerners, instead of offering plans to save the world, it's more time for us to seek out some other people's ideas of what changes need to happen, and to enforce the type of unity which is more dynamic and more organic. So those are just a couple of additional notions on the question of who is this Christ that we await in Advent.
Question, David?
Yes.
What's to stop in this idea, what's to stop one from going one step further and saying, well, who are we to whip a little Christ on these people who have their own religions, which they think are true?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one way to stop that is to look for Christ in the other people. Mm-hmm. Now, it is true that you can say, well, you're laying a framework on those people that they don't really need. But it depends on for whose purposes you seek to do that. If it's for purposes, I mean, if I go out to discover Christ in the Islamic faith, there's two ways I can do that. I can do that to show Muslims that they're really Christians, or I can do that to enrich my own understanding of Christ. And I think that if I do so in the latter spirit, that my vision of God will grow and be stronger. And I mean, just as I really appreciated the matins this morning. And I think there's much that speaks to my own sense of spiritual faith, which is Christian, in what I encounter in the spiritual tradition of Native America. And so I don't think that by looking for Christ in those traditions for the purpose of strengthening my own image of God, that I necessarily lay anything on those people.
So you're going into it with a personal gain attitude.
Right. Like I was saying on Monday, I think that is, in fact, the best way to encounter another people's, because when people feel that you respect them, it's a self-perpetuating process. As someone who comes and respects me, I also think rather highly of. And the people that we think highly of, we tend to learn from. So I don't think it's strictly a one-way process of what's going on. I'm just saying that I think our attitude needs to be stronger on the issue of what have I got to learn than what have I got to give. Because what I have to give will flow naturally if I'm learning from those people. You with me there?
Mm-hmm. You're not advocating completely one way, though, I would think. Otherwise, they'd never find out who Christ was if you kept it to yourself and just came to being.
I'm not advocating denying them any understanding of my way of Christ. I mean, it's one thing to deny someone the response to their questions, and it's another thing to seek to raise questions for them. I'm not going into the situation to promote their raising of religious questions, but I do think that that will be a natural product of my own raising of religious questions for myself. I think it's an infectious process, and that where you kind of promote someone by taking an interest in who they are, you bond yourself to that person, and sooner or later that person is going to want to know who you are as well. And that in that process there will be an exchange. But I think we need, especially as Westerners, doing some kind of historical critique of how we've operated in the world. We need to correct what we can see to be a problem that we have, namely that we tend to go out more in the spirit of changing others than in changing ourselves. So I think one way to correct that is to just reverse the process a little bit. And then people are always nervous that, well, then maybe we won't be spreading the gospel. I don't think we need to be nervous about that. I think it'll be a natural process. Truth is appealing. And if we seek it, we will draw others into the search as well. So now, into what situation does this Christ come to us? That's also an important theme of Advent as you read the lessons this Sunday, or preparation for Sunday. There's this strong notion of the end times, strongly apocalyptic theme to the lessons of Advent that we get into now. And the notion that we are living in the end times, at the end of the world. It's the kind of lectionary which makes some of us nervous because of the way that apocalyptic literature has been used by some Christians in recent years. I'm thinking of the kind of books that Hal Lindsey writes, and those people who are sure from their reading of the signs of the times that we are at the end of the age, and that as soon as Russia moves into the Middle East, it's all going to blow up, and or the kind of thinking that says which I've heard propounded at groups of Lutheran clergy, who are addressing themselves to the issue of the arms race. Well, what about the notion that God is really in control of the world anyway, and that sooner or later God may choose to bring an end to the world, and that the means by which God seeks to end the world might be a nuclear holocaust? So who are we to work against nuclear holocaust if that's God's plan? That kind of apocalyptic vision, which says there is no future to be creatively worked with, rather the future is simply a process of the unfolding of God's will, and we just go along with it. I say that those problems of apocalypticism have been problematic for some Christians, and myself included, in recent times, and so we tend to get nervous when these highly apocalyptic texts make their way into our lectionary, as they will on Sunday. Certainly, if we take the example of the world that I was pointing to on Monday night in Southern Africa, we have to say that we do expect Christ to come into a situation of full of sin and despair. Can't spend too much time looking at Southern Africa without getting pretty depressed at the shape of things there. Zimbabwe might be exciting, but if you go too deep into Zimbabwe, there's a lot which is depressing there as well. And certainly in a place like South Africa, the future looks very bleak. So we expect Christ to come into a situation of despair like South Africa, but not just South Africa. I guess I could never have sustained my interest in teaching about Southern Africa if I thought it was just another part of the world, another cause for us to give our attention to. I said I couldn't have sustained my interest in working with that issue beyond an initial reporting back of my experience when I first came back from South Africa. The reason I continue to raise information about Southern Africa is because what I learned in South Africa is that black South Africans are saying nothing to white South Africans, that the whole third world isn't trying to say to the whole first world. In other words, I raise issues of Southern Africa because I think it's a very seductive microcosm of problems that we face on an even larger and perhaps more terrible scale here in the United States, or in as Americans in our relationship with the world. I say it's a seductive way of raising those issues because South Africa being far away, and that's how most Americans think about it, as a far corner of the world, we tend to be a little bit more objective in the judgments that we make about that situation. I find that if you want to raise issues of racism here in the United States, it's very difficult to get white middle-class Americans to make anti-racist judgments. And we more often are inclined rather defensively to see a rationale for the way things are. But if you discuss the issue of racism in South Africa, people tend to think of it as far enough away and as not being, I mean, we don't tend to see our own personal involvement in that situation, and so we're quicker to make judgments and say, well, yeah, the whites are wrong here. They shouldn't be behaving this way, and the blacks have got a good complaint. And once people can be seduced into making that kind of a relatively objective judgment, I think then it's very easy to draw the parallels to our own situation and to say, well, is there any difference between the way whites treat blacks in South Africa and between situation X, Y, or Z here in the United States? If you want some good examples of those parallels as well as the differences, this is a new book. It just came out from Oxford University Press. Well, not just. It's maybe a year old now. A paperback called White Supremacy. And it's a very good academic historical, comparative historical study of the doctrine of white supremacy in American and South African history. I learned more about U.S. history in reading the book than I did about South African history, but that's, I suspect, largely because of my own study of South African history over the last few years. It was interesting to me that my interest in South African history should lead me to learn some things about American history, but that's an example of how and why I think the issue of Southern Africa can be a seductive way of drawing us into the process of facing the world that we are too often inclined to want to hide from. George Fredrickson wrote White Supremacy, which sells for $6.95. And particularly if you like reading history, as I do, I think you find it an immensely stimulating book. And what hope to this desperate world does the Christ bring? That's really the theme for today. But it is a theme conditioned by my own biases. I said on Monday morning that when I talked about my vision of Christ, I didn't think that was the only true vision of Christ, but it was my vision of Christ. It was the Christ that I've seen that I can't help but try and share. And the same is true for this question of what hope I think the Christ brings. I don't think that what I'm about to talk about is the only hope that Christ offers to the world, but it is the hope that fills my life and that I want to share with you. It's a hope that has been conditioned in a way that, say, my father's vision of Christian hope was not conditioned. I have been, in the course of the last, in the course of growing, sensitive to some of Christianity, some of modern Christianity's great intellectual critics. And I'm a great believer that in criticism there is always some useful grains of truth. And that while I may not agree with critics of Christianity like Marx and Freud, I think they offer us a great deal of insight into some of our own weaknesses. I guess I wouldn't be a Christian if I thought they had all the answers. But I certainly think they have a great deal of insight. And when Freud talks about religion as an illusion, I think he's touched a sensitive button for us Christians that we need to, rather than hide from, take seriously. I think that too often the kind of apocalyptic or the sense of eschatology that I at least was raised on in the Missouri Synod is a bit illusory in its relationship to the world in which we live. Missionaries have been criticized in the Third World for bringing a pie-in-the-sky religion, for telling people that the issues of life in this world are not so great as the issues of life after death, and that we ought not concern ourselves with life now. Somehow the coming of Christ to our world is a coming in the future, more than a coming in the present. And so we build up these illusions of the future, which become the basis for life in the present. And I think that Freud he was condemning religion. I don't think it was accurate to condemn religion for its illusion. If he had read a little more Eastern philosophy, he might have come to the conclusion that all is illusory. And so there's nothing wrong with the illusion so much as how the illusion relates to our life. Marx, in an almost similar fashion, I think it was Marx that said, the point is not to analyze the world, but to change it. Am I right? Am I quoting the right source for that? Pretty sure it's Karl Marx that said that. Correct me if I'm wrong. Somebody knows it. But again, I think Marx was hitting a sore spot for Christians. The idea that he wasn't just talking about Christians, but he came out of a Christian culture, and so presumably it was Christianity that most profoundly affected his judgment, that religion tends to have very little to do with changing the structures of the world, with some type of an active presence in the world. So the eschatology to which I point, the sense of what hope Christ can bring, is conditioned by the critics, by some of our critics like Marx and Freud, who I think have got some valid, whose vision of the limitations of modern Christian practice can be instructive to us. Now, to point to the kind of eschatology which I like and identify with in the wake of the sort of criticism that I've talked about, I want to read to you a quote that I just last week ran into from Johannes Baptist Metz, who is offering us an alternative apocalyptic vision to the one that I was citing as problematic for me, at least, a few minutes ago. Metz writes, "It would be a mistake to think that after the Christ event, our future already is over and done with, as if after the birth of Christ, there is no future to be realized, but only one to be unfolded. No future to be realized, but only one to be unfolded. On the contrary, the Christ event gives added stimulus to attempts to shape the world. The preaching of the resurrection, which can never be separated from the preaching of the cross, is essentially a missionary preaching of promise." Missionary preaching of promise. I'd never thought about missionary preachings of promise in that attractive of a light before, I don't think. And the notion that promise is related to hope. In obedience to it. And notice it doesn't say here in opting for this view, but in obedience to it, the Christian attempts to transform the world in the direction of the new world, which is promised to us once and for all in Christ Jesus. Creative expectation is the secret essence of Christian existence in the New Testament. Creative expectation. I guess I believe that this notion to create the new world we expect because of the hope that Christ gives us, a hope rooted in the resurrection and the cross. That's some of the hope that drives my life and that I want to share with you. Now, I suppose the question becomes, having laid out this vision of the hope that Christ brings to the world, the question becomes, how do we creatively expect? How do we do this creative expectation? And the answer I would want to suggest, as informed by Lutheran theology, is that we don't do the creative expectation, but Christ does. And we only pursue it. And as a way of making that rather abstract notion a little bit more concrete, I want to tell a story that some of you are familiar with because I gather Langdon Gilkey's book, Shantung Compound, is familiar to many of you. And it's also a story I've told in the village before, but so well makes the point that we cannot do what's expected of us, but it comes to us. I want to tell the story that Gilkey tells in his book, Enchantum Compound. For those of you, I presume not all of you, who knows the book? Not everybody. Okay, I can tell the story. The book is Gilkey's reflections, some 30 years later, of his life in a Japanese prisoner of war camp in China during World War II. Gilkey was teaching, working as a missionary in China. World War II broke out. The Japanese invaded China. They rounded up the expatriates, who were largely missionaries, and put them in a concentration camp. But the Japanese were astute in their administration of the camp. They were not about to tell the prisoners of war, this is where you live, and here's the food you eat, and like it or lump it. They knew there'd be a lot of complaints about the rather harsh conditions of life in the camp. And so what they did was to say to these group of people in the camp, there are three buildings over there, you decide how to house yourself in those buildings. Fight it out amongst yourself how to share this limited space. Here's 100 pounds of flour a week, you decide how to feed yourselves. It's up to you. We give you a few basic resources, and you fight it out amongst yourself how to share. Now, Gilkey, 30 years later, has written a book called Shantung Compound, which discusses, which reflects on his experiences in that camp. And he tells in particular one story that I really like as for what it says about a certain law of human nature. Gilkey was what the camp did in a very good Western fashion was form committees to deal with the various sharing of resources that needed to take place. And Gilkey was made chairman of the housing committee, which meant that that following the initial allocation of housing, it was his responsibility to follow up complaints that anyone had about how housing had been allocated and to investigate and to try and mediate a just solution to those complaints. And he talks about how frustrating it was in this situation to deal with those complaints, until one day a delegation came to him and said, we represent 23 people who are living in room X over there in the building, and we feel we have a just complaint because across the hall from us there's a room which has 21 people living in it, and one day we tricked all of those people into being out of the room at the same time, and one of us snuck in there and we measured the dimensions of the room. It's exactly the same size as our room. They have 21 people, we have 23. Two rooms exactly the same size, and we think we have a just complaint. We want you to make this situation right by evening out this imbalance. And Gilkey says that on that day he said a prayer of thanks to God that finally a clear-cut issue had come before him, that finally he was called to intervene in a situation where there could be no argument as to what is justice. Well, he talks about going along to the room of 21 and having and listening while they point out to him that they do not think it is just in their already overcrowded condition to have to take on another roommate. Now, the story illustrates, I think, the notion that of how difficult it is for human beings to gain a just perspective on a situation if they have a self-interest to protect in their reading of that situation. And to relate it to our concern for justice in Southern Africa, perhaps we could say that those people who have interests to protect in Southern Africa are thereby disqualified from any ability to gain a just perspective as to how to resolve that situation. If that's true, then we Americans have to be disqualified from knowing what would a just solution to the problems in Southern Africa be. In fact, the rich people in the world might well be disqualified from arguing their perspective on issues of justice. There's a sense in which I think the story illustrates that the need for wholeness of perspective. as well as the notion that within that in locating ourselves somewhere within the whole, we would do well to ask ourselves what our who has more of an interest in the status quo than others, and to look to those others as maybe having a perspective closer to the truth of the whole. So in terms of doing the creative expectation that life in Christ, or our the hope that we look to Christ to bring the world, our role is less to plan that creativity than to find our way of participating, almost in a supportive rather than a leading role. As another example of the value of a broadness of perspective, I would suggest that we consider the analogy of osmosis. I'd ask Nate if he wouldn't just explain osmosis quickly to us, the principle of osmosis, and then I'll relate it to our sense of justice.
So, yeah, as I understand it, osmosis is when you pass some particles through a barrier from a region of less concentration to a region of higher concentration.
And is my understanding correct that the more radical the difference between those two concentrations, the greater the passage, or the greater the rate of passage?
Well,
yes. Yeah. The chemist behind me says yes. Yeah. Good. Now I think that's a useful analogy for those people seeking an ecumenical vision. It has been said that if our our horizons of ecumenism are narrow, i.e., the coming together of a few strains of Lutheranism in the United States in the 20th century, as opposed to the coming together of the world religions, our rate of growth, or our rate of movement, will be less than it would be in the latter case.
Let's say in the ecumenical movement, the broader the perspective that we strive for, the easier it will be to make those small steps. I think that if, as Lutherans, our vision of the ecumenical movement was the coming together of the whole world, the whole of God's creation, then issues of Lutheran union would be so minute that we would have accomplished it long ago. But for 20th century American Lutherans, to whom the ecumenical movement means whether the ALC and the Missouri Synod can have communion together. Of course, there is some differences there that we can focus on, but if that's the dimension, if those are the horizons of our focus, then our progress toward the equilibrium of the whole will be much slower than might be the case to which we're called.
In worldview, does that indicate that there is one right way for the world to believe? Because from other things, we've been talking about celebrating the differences and the diversity and how that's good and how all parts together make the whole. So wouldn't it be better if we just left things, each group go as they are?
Yeah, that's where I think the analogy of osmosis breaks down, because under the principle of osmosis, as I understand it, there is eventual uniformity within the equilibrium. Is that?
Well, a pressure gets set up which equalizes on the two sides.
All right. I think the analogy still breaks down in relation to what we're discussing here, because I already said that I don't think the type of unity to which we're called is a unity of homogeneity. I think it's a unity of strength and diversity. But I guess I would believe that out of that strength, eventually certain truths would predominate, or you know, greater truths would predominate over lesser truths. I mean, it is the case that among different traditions there are actual contradictions. And in the unity of the whole, while I think there can be a unity which allows those contradictions to exist side by side, I guess I would believe that where there is a contradiction and people get together, sooner or later, there may be some winning out of one view over the other. I guess in terms of my own cultural values, and that's all they are really, I would tend to believe that in the encounter between Western Christianity and traditional African religion, that a greater truth which Western culture might have to offer African culture stems out of our contemporary thinking about sexism. And what does the issues of sexual egalitarianism say to a polygamous situation? I coming from my own cultural, historical, specific situation, think that there might be something that I might have a truth to offer Africa in that situation. But I don't think I should ever really pretend to know that that's the case until I have really been engaged in a creative encounter with Africans about that. Because what we're, I'm sure, going to find out is that there are some rationales to their system that we haven't thought about either. And for that reason, I say the contradictions have to exist side by side at some stage, but might ultimately be ironed out. But I don't think that there would be, I can't imagine a point on our path so far down the road that we reach a state of total equilibrium where everyone is the same.
Will there be a tendency for the majority to bring about the truth rather than the minority?
If we adopt Western standards of democracy, we might be faced with that danger. If we adopt the standards of democracy operative in Africa, where decisions are not arrived at until consensus has occurred, regardless of how long it takes to achieve that.
But what if that went as far as, you know, instead of us finding the truth, we came to a consensus, we came to the idea that Christ is not Lord? Can you handle that?
How would we perhaps arrive at that?
You're coming with the attitude that Christ is Lord in this big system, this worldview, all the world religions. And if we all got together and ironed out everything, and all of a sudden Christ isn't Lord.
Well, I suspect that you and I might have some differences that we could creatively encounter about along those lines. Because my notion of Christ as Lord means that the way of Christ is a way of coming into union with all these differences. It is not the imperial vision of unity which says the Christ that I know and that I relate to, my Christ, my specific understanding of Christ, is the Lord, or the one to which the whole world should be obedient. I would rather say that the Christ which offers us that sacrificial image of the cross is a way by which I can come into relationship with others, and that makes Christ Lord. The fact that this Christ can bring me into relationship with one who is so different from me through the vision of the cross is a way of that illustrates a lordship, a governance in my life, which makes Christ Lord, even if it helps me understand that there's something worth being obedient to in the Buddhist way of life as well.
I don't want to get into here.
Yeah, okay, we could, I'm sure, spend a long time on So the hope of Christ, the hope of Christ for our lives, as I read the will of Christ's larger body, which is, I think, an instructive thing for us to do, is to nurture or grow a larger worldview. I think that's what the that's what I hear the body of Christ saying to that member of Christ, which is 20th century American Christianity. Please adopt or open yourselves to a larger worldview, because we have so much power and influence and affluence and resources, yet we also have such a tremendous bias of our own self-interest that we need a larger worldview in order to use our resources for the good of the whole. And the final thing I want to say is that I don't think that's not a cause we give our lives to. I was raised being told that one option for my life would be to give my life to missions. But I guess particularly in light of what Jack was stimulating me to think about along the lines of our baptism the other night, there's a sense in which the hope of Christ is life given to us through our baptism. It is not as though this cause of seeking a larger worldview is an option that you might choose or that we might choose to do with our life. Rather, by virtue of being baptized into the one body, we thereby say, life comes to us in this manner, and we can do nothing but pursue this cause. Now, the reason I wanted to do a presentation like this morning is because I always end up leaving Holden Village feeling like, it's fine and good, and I shared some information about a part of the world that people don't otherwise have very much direct encounter with, but I always go away saying, well, you know, the point of the whole thing is not to analyze the world so much as to change. And I guess I think that at its best, that's also the point of Advent. Point of Christ coming anew. And so I have long felt that I should share with you, maybe it's a call to conversion, to commitment. I think we need more people who feed on the life that comes from seeking a larger worldview. I can say that it has been a rich feast to the extent that I have fed my life on that, and I would recommend it to anyone who's thinking about their life ahead. The feast of seeking wholeness among the body of Christ is a rich one, and is something of what the Feast of Thanksgiving also symbolizes for me. So, by way of encouraging you to follow up on these sessions, rather than feel like you have covered questions of justice in Southern Africa, as a way of seeing to it that this is a beginning rather than a coverage of some of those issues, I want to point to a few resources that can take you on your way. I often say that I don't think my job is to teach people what I think they ought to know about Southern Africa so much as to convince them that this is a subject which we need to pursue. And if any of you have reached that point this week, then I think the single best way you can pursue a better understanding of Africa is from a little weekly news digest called African News that comes to my post office box every Monday. It takes me about 25 minutes a week to read. That is very densely written information with almost nothing in the way of political rhetoric.
It's not opinion so much as it is information about current events all over the continent of Africa and also about U.S.-Africa relations. I've learned more about the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund from reading African News than I have any other source of information, because African News tells me how the World Bank and the IMF affect Africa and how these institutions reflect American thinking. African News is published by a collective of people in Durham, North Carolina. Many of them first gained their experience of Africa by traveling to Africa under church-sponsored programs in the early 1960s or the mid-60s, and then came back to the United States and said, what we can offer Africa that Africa really needs is a better source of news about Africa aimed at the American people. You don't have to be an expert on African affairs to read African News. Experts on Africa do find it valuable to read African News, but it's aimed at the average American who knows nothing about Africa but wants to start learning. If you subscribe and start reading it cover to cover for every week as it comes, you'll find the first few months it's kind of overwhelming, a lot of new strange names and places, and it's hard to follow at first, but people from Holden, who have heard me talk about African News and who I've had contact with a year later, said, you know, the first few months, it was all very confusing, and after about 3 months of disciplined reading, I got into their cycle of reporting, and I found that I was understanding everything that they wrote. But I think it does take a few months of reading before you can expect to follow, because it's a big continent, and there's a lot more coverage here of areas that we know nothing about. I find it immensely satisfying thing to read, just because I learned so much about Africa. I mean, it was ironic to me that in this recent trip to Africa, I felt starved for information about current events on the continent, because I wasn't getting my weekly hit of African news. Well, maybe that's enough of a promotion there. A couple of sample issues here. Take them to your room and read through them if you want, but please give them back to me before you leave, because these are issues that were published while I was away and that I have not yet read, so I want them back.
Where do we get that information?
If you want to subscribe, take one of these brochures, because it offers a special... thank you. Yes, thank you. It offers a special introductory subscription rate, cut rate introductory rate. So. Well, I tell you what, I'll put them over here on this corner so that those of you who are interested in one of these on your way out, take them. I don't have unlimited quantities, otherwise I would give everybody one and let those who don't want to throw it away. But rather than do that, I'll just say, those of you who are interested to take one of those, you can sign up for $19 a year, which is a pretty good price for a weekly publication.
Where do they get their information?
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't understand your question. They do it in a number of ways. As I said, they're based in Durham, North Carolina. They have a number of correspondents based in Africa who supply them with stories as need arises. They systematically monitor shortwave radio broadcasts from all over the world. I mean, they cover all the shortwave radio broadcasts that they think can supply them with useful information. If they occur at 3 o'clock in the morning, they tape them, and then somebody goes through them the next day. Amongst their staff, they divide up all the relevant publications about Africa that they think are worth covering. And so any given member of the staff has a half a dozen different publications that they monitor on a regular basis. And they not only read it, but they index everything that they read. They have probably the most sophisticated indexing system for information on Africa that exists anywhere in the United States right now. And increasingly, they're used as a research center for people doing research on Africa. If you want to do a paper on coal mining in Zambia, you can go to their index and find virtually every reference to coal mining in Zambia that has occurred in print in the last 10 years that they've been in operation doing this indexing. And then their own Durham staff makes travels to Africa and has a big phone budget to Africa, and so that's how they get their information. They're doing a good enough job that there are an increasing number of African newspapers that use African News now to get information about other parts of the continent. Very well respected in Africa. They're just about, they're just on the verge of launching a major radio service, and you can expect late next year sometime to start running into their reports on National Public Radio or other radio news services. And they are increasingly besieged by newspaper reporters from the, you know, the New York Times or the Washington Post or places like that who are given an assignment on Africa and who will start their research in Durham, North Carolina, which doesn't pay the people in Durham so much as it pays the reporters in the New York Times, but it's a valuable service and something they believe to be part of their ministry. I think many of them would see what they do as a ministry. They got their money to get started with some grants from church denominations, but every year the percentage of their budget, which is self-supporting, goes up. And they expect to be a self-supporting, subscriber-owned news service rather than an advertiser-owned news service before too much longer. I can't recommend them too highly. Something else that I will pass out, since John has given me copies of, is this little document called The New World View, Internationalization of Mission in the United States. I would encourage you as a follow-up to this session just to read it over sometime. It's put out by the ALC. It's one of the best things on mission theology that I've seen from anybody, let alone Lutherans. I'm also proud of the fact that I was talking to some people at the ALC Interpretation Office when they were planning this document, and at that time I told them about the North and South map, which they were very excited to learn about and which you can see they've made good use of. Some other, maybe if we can take, I think we've got five more minutes, some other resources that I'd want to point to because of their possibilities for an active component. And I do get criticized for not being strong enough on the action side and being more strong on the intellectual information side, so I'm really trying to renew that problem a little bit. There's a church-sponsored lobby in Washington, D.C. called the Washington Office on Africa. And if you are of the persuasion that you have enough faith in our democracy to believe that we can and should be influencing it, then the best way to do so vis-a-vis Africa is by sending $5 a year to the Washington Office on Africa or more. They don't limit your contribution to $5. That's really all they require. For 110 Maryland Avenue Northeast, Washington, D.C., 2002. They will send you a little newsletter which tells you what letter to what Congress people can have the greatest impact at the right time. You know, I mean, I think it's useful to write your congressman and congresswoman and to let them know that you care about U.S. Foreign policy towards Namibia and you are watching their actions in that regard. It's helpful to write a letter like that. But sometimes it can be more productive in terms of the kind of democracy we have to write a specific members of a specific committee at a time when they are faced with a vote on a crucial bill that is before them, and for the Congress people to learn that there are a big number of people. The Washington Office on Africa has been responsible for some major victories in recent years. The most recent of which I can think of how many know the Clark Amendment? I've heard of a couple of people. The Clark Amendment was, Dick Clark was a senator from Iowa, who was responsible at the time of when civil war broke out in Angola, the CIA moved in there, and Senator Clark, who was active vis-a-vis African affairs at that time, I think was chairman of the Senate Subcommittee on African Affairs, got through a bill which made it illegal for the CIA to engage in secret activities in countries without letting at least some people in Congress know what they were doing or getting permission. Is that an accurate understanding of the bill? And this, of course, was a great, hung around the neck of the CIA like a tremendous yoke about which they complained greatly, you know, restricting their ability to
work on behind the scenes. And one of the first things that Reagan did when he came into office was say that he wanted to repeal the Clark Amendment. And not only vis-a-vis Angola, but because of the precedent that it set for other countries as well. And I would say that it was the work of the Washington Office on Africa, which mounted a campaign among its supporters that was really more than anything else responsible. And not just, you know, they don't just get letters out of us. They also do a lot of important lobbying in the Capitol. But we can be part of their effort, both by financially supporting them and also by getting on that mailing list, which only takes $5 a year, and knowing when there is a need to lobby on a given bill at a given time. If you want literature on Africa, there is, am I taking this off the board too soon? There is an organization called the American Committee on Africa. And I would recommend anybody who's interested in pursuing issues of justice in Africa at all to write to the American Committee on Africa, 198 Broadway, New York City. I wonder if I can remember the zip code. Anyway, it'll get there without that. Otherwise, I will try and come up with it, the zip code today and offer it tonight. Oh, no, I don't have the zip code here. I got their phone number. Not that that'll do a whole village any good, huh? Ask for their literature list. And they'll send you free of charge a little list that lists maybe 150 pamphlets that cost about 15 cents a piece on every conceivable dimension of, you know, what you, anything you ever wanted to know about issues of justice in Africa, you know. Krugerrands, if you're interested in the issue of Krugerrands, there's a lot of stuff on the whole question of divestment that they publish. You know, the case for divestment, African voices for divestment in Southern Africa. They don't deal with the development issues all across the continent, but they do promote awareness about some of the justice issues in Africa, like the Polisario War in the Sahara, or the struggles in Southern Africa. You know, they're strong along those types of things. So those are some network organizations by which you can get active vis-a-vis the issue of Southern Africa. But the strongest one that I would urge you to consider is Africa News, because I believe if you're reading Africa News, you're going to know what issues of activism are relevant for Americans at any given time. You know, they will cover. If the divestment issue is hot, you'll know about it because you're reading Africa News. I can tell you what issue is being pushed right now, but a year or two from now, it may be something else. And so it's not so important to get information about the current situation now as it is to get plugged into some network of information that can regularly keep us informed. And all of this, as I would urge upon you in conclusion, is not to do good for the world, but because the world has a lot of good to offer us.